I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday, August 31st, 57 degrees, currently in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Giboy. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and happy Tuesday, everybody. Hopefully everybody's Tuesday is off to a good start. We're looking at a pretty normal summer day for this last day of August. Unfortunately, though, the main story in Park City today is going to continue to just be that patchy smoke. So the air quality still not looking to be the best, but we are beginning to see our wind switching more out of the southwest. And this is what we've been talking about over the last couple of days. And moisture is starting to stream its way northward through Utah. And by later today, maybe this afternoon into this evening, an isolated shower or storm can't be ruled out. The rain chance through the afternoon, not all that high, around 20%. But keep that in mind if you're heading out and about for today. It's also going to be on the warm side, temperatures climbing into the lower 80s in Park City. But as that moisture continues to stream in, that rain chance is actually going to start to increase as we move into tonight. So just under a 50-50 chance that a shower or thunderstorm finds you as we make our way into the nighttime hours tonight, with temperatures dropping eventually into the middle and upper 50s for overnight lows. Our best chance of rain is going to be coming tomorrow, and that's going to be during the day with about a 70% rain chance, where showers and thunderstorms are going to be likely. Not everybody could find rain, but it's going to be probably a pretty good chance, especially compared to what we've gotten used to. So tomorrow, mostly cloudy, scattered showers, a few thunderstorms. Temperatures will also be running on the cooler side as well, lower 70s. We still could see some patchy smoke, but I'm hopeful with more of a southerly wind that'll help push some of the smoke away. And then we'll keep a chance for a few showers and thunderstorms into Wednesday evening before we're looking at mostly dry skies Wednesday night into Thursday morning. But with enough lingering moisture left behind, scattered showers and thunderstorms still going to be a possibility Thursday into Thursday night. But the rain chance drops from 70% Wednesday to around 40 to 30% Thursday into Thursday night. And then just about all the moisture will be getting out of here as we head into the upcoming weekend. So a 1 in 5 rain chance on Friday. Temperatures will still remain on the cooler side. We're looking at middle 70s for highs Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, with overnight lows in the 50s. And then as we start to dry things out into the upcoming weekend with sunshine, those temperatures will hold steady for daytime highs, middle to upper 70s, with morning lows in the middle 50s.
Okay, Thomas, thanks so much. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, we'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Later on, Summit County Health Director Phil Bondurant with the latest on Summit County getting into the high transmission level of COVID-19 and what that means. Finally, Park City Friends of the Library board member Erby Leary with an update on this year's book sale and author luncheon. Well, the Summit County Council will be meeting tomorrow starting at 2:30 in the work session at the Richens Services Building, with interviews for vacancies on the North Summit Recreation District. They'll be going back into a closed session and then reopening the work session at 4:30. On the phone with a preview, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
First off, the council will be looking at compensation and benefits. The county commissioned a study looking at what they pay their employees compared to other entities and jurisdictions. The result of the study, though, won't come out until later September or October. What do you think that's going to tell you?
Well, I think, like most employers these days, I mean, we're all reading about nationally and locally how the labor market is tough to get employees. Employers are having to pay more. It wouldn't certainly we have worked very hard to try and keep up with the market, but I don't think we're immune to any of those things as an employer. So I think we're going to see some of that. As well, it's been a long time since we've looked across our organization, and we're actually helping some of our special districts also look at their organizations to see where certain positions might have gone up or down around the market over the last few years, as the case may be. One of the places that's very key that we've been talking about is certainly in law enforcement. That's been a highlight in local government lately.
Yeah, and certainly a few months back you heard from Sheriff Justin Martinez that they were having trouble finding staff. Do you have other departments with the same problem?
Well, I mean, it depends on what opens up. So one of the anecdotes that we have from this last year is that we were not able to hire somebody to do our summer chipping program on the east side of the county. We just did not get applicants for that position. It could be the pay rate. It could be the job. We don't know really what happened. It wasn't our highest priority to have that position filled. But then we, just in the last 2 weeks, we did get an applicant. So We may be running that program in the fall, but those types of situations seem to come up as we have openings.
Okay. Let's see. The council will also discuss and possibly approve a refined, locally preferred alternative for bus rapid transit along both sides of Highway 224. So can you kind of run through what is the plan for BRT here?
Yeah, sure can. So, you know, we've been planning on and been working on going through the environmental and selection process of what the project will actually be over the past 3 or 4 years. We had a locally preferred alternative that had the termini or the ends of the routes, one at Kimball Junction and one in the Bonanza area of Park City. We have collectively decided that Bonanza isn't the right terminus, and that the Old Town Transit Center is a better option. That has been a determination over the last year. So within this bigger process of you know, complying with the National Environmental Protection Act in regards to getting these projects ready for funding, we have to readopt that preferred alternative with that new termini in order to get it going into the hopper.
Well, and I know that Summit County was never a fan of the Bonanza Arts and Culture District for the terminus, but why does the Old Town Transit Center make a better terminus? I mean, it's so congested there, especially on big events. I mean, it's, you know, buses have a hard time getting in.
I believe that the Park City staff has and council have looked at their overall plans, looked at where they want to center their transit system in the future, and the Old Town Transit Center still makes the most sense for them. It's certainly a nod to their preference, you know, it's Park City jurisdiction, and we're going to follow their lead on that.
Okay. In terms of the what's going to happen along Highway 224, again, we're going to have a BRT basically on the outsides of both of those lanes?
Yeah, so it's what's called side running. So there will be essentially a third lane created with some of the shoulder and probably some additional pavement in order to accommodate not only our transit buses, but school buses are able to use that route. And we're also exploring the idea of any kind of collected vehicle. So if there's a private service that has you know, several different people on the vehicle, they might be able to use that side running lane also. So that would also work in conjunction with our signal system, so that those buses would have priority as they approach signals. Very similar to the way that emergency equipment has that priority when they're in an emergency situation. So combined, those things should make the BRT system a faster way of getting in and out of town in the future.
All right. When can all of this happen?
Well, it requires quite a bit of funding, as you would expect. So we've been working over the past 3 years. We've applied to the Federal Transit Administration for some large grants. This year, we're going after $25 million in order to partially fund that program. There will end up being local, state, and federal money in this project, which probably will run somewhere between $50 and $60 million when it's all said and done.
Yikes. So if the council does endorse this BRT for Highway 224, what happens next?
Well, it's a step, again, in the environmental clearance process. So we've been working on that document with the Federal Transit Administration and UDOT for about the past year. Probably will take about another year to finish that up. In the meantime, we're trying to gather together the funding to advance this project. And it could be advanced in pieces as well. It doesn't have to all be done at once. We have some logical segments between Kimball Junction and the canyons, and then the canyons in Park City that we could work on. So depending on how that all gets funded, we could see this starting to be built, or at least right away starting to be acquired, because there is some small right away acquisitions that would need to be made in order to make this work, as early as 2023-2024.
Okay. Then at 6 o'clock, the description of public input has been changed. Now it's, quote, any matter not on the agenda and not the subject of a pending land use application. Does this mean that you don't want any more impromptu public hearings on Dakota Pacific or similar development projects?
Well, and there's a good reason for that. You know, as development projects make their way through the process, you know, both the Planning Commission and the Council is not supposed. There's very, very strict rules, legal parameters around how they can hear public input and how these can be processed. And if we violate those rules, they can put the county at risk from legal challenge if different sides don't see something that they like in that project. So those are the reason those rules are put in place and why the attorney's office has been speaking about that lately.
Sure. And we had heard from one county council member that she'd like to have the public hearing reopened. I understand that can be done if the county so chooses. Will you reopen the public hearing on Dakota Pacific?
Totally a council call on that. Of course, you know, as with most public hearings, they have to be noticed properly, which means that they have a certain period of time before that hearing that they have to be noticed publicly in newspapers and on websites. So we'll see as this comes back to the council, which could be a few more weeks before that happens. I'm sure we'll be discussing the public input portion of that between the council and the attorney's office so that we make sure that we line things up correctly.
All right. Just some off agenda items I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
Legally, health orders have to be issued by the county manager and by the health director. And I've got health director Phil Bondurant here up next to discuss that change of the county's transmission level to high. So are the two of you talking about whether to implement another school order for grades K through 12, which was advocated by some speakers during public comment last week?
Well, we had considered that before the current health order was, or order of constraint was put in place, and the associated emergency order. I think really our next step is probably more around looking at, you know, our 30 days of the emergency order when it has to be re-looked at and then either re-ratified or discussed by the council comes up at the 23rd of this month of September. So we have a couple of meetings to discuss that with the council, and we'll probably have it up on their agenda on the 22nd. We're probably going to be looking at the data that exists. We'll have almost a full month of school being back in session. To see how transmission is happening within the schools. But we'll be analyzing that over that whole period in order to make some recommendations to the council or discuss that with council so that Dr. Bondurant can make an informed decision.
Okay. So even though, and I certainly asked Phil this, but even though we are in high transmission, the school the school mask order for elementary kids does not go into effect until we hit that 2% threshold, right?
That's correct. You know, so far, the order that we've put in place has not seen any challenge from either the legislature or anybody at the state. It seems to be well supported. And in fact, we're seeing other areas of the state consider putting something similar in place. I think we're going to continue to look at the data and make our judgments from there. I think the other thing that we need to start considering is working with our local businesses in town as we get into the fall and winter to prepare for what our winter is going to look like, because obviously we're going to be moving indoors for some of our activities, and that depending on what our transmission rates look like, we might be discussing some different protocols with them.
Yeah, and heard this morning about the state of Florida withholding money to school districts who have gone against the mask ban. Is that something that we could see here as well?
Well, I mean, you know, in our case, they've put the legislature has put the burden on the local health director and county councils and county managers to make those determinations. So I don't, you know, it's really up to the school districts to follow those protocols once the the public health system has put those in place. You know, in our case, we're working very closely together. We've built great relationships. We had great relationships, and we've built them even stronger over the last 2 years. With all of the folks in our community, including school districts that have had to put these and monitor these different orders. I think we're going to continue working closely together.
Okay, Tom, anything else you'd like to mention?
That's all I've got today.
Thank you. Well, late last week, Summit County was raised back to the high level of COVID-19 transmission. In the studio with details, I have Summit County Health Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what does this mean for Summit County to go into this high level of transmission of COVID-19?
Well, you know, this isn't the first time that Summit County has been in the high transmission index. We've seen ourselves here before and transitioned back and forth. But really what it is it's the same metrics that were used over the last 18 months to determine where we're at. And so when we look at what sent us into this new level of transmission, it was really the hospital utilization and ICU utilization across the state. Right now, the metric is set that it's 72% of ICU utilization and 15% of COVID-19 ICU utilization. Is that high level of transmission. Statewide, it's at 85% for that general ICU and 32.2% ICU utilization for COVID-19 patients. So really concerning, given what's occurred over the last few weeks in the state, that we're seeing those trends bump up in our ICU capacity throughout the state.
Yeah, we still have about 5 counties, though, that are in the low transmission rate. So why don't those statewide figures affect them?
Yeah, so good question. There's 3 metrics that are used. It's 7-day average percent positivity, 14-day case rate per 100,000 population, and again, that statewide ICU utilization. When we look at those 3 metrics, if you qualify for 2 of the 3, that sends you into the high transmission index. Well, we don't have any control specifically in Summit County over ICU utilization. Obviously, we do in personal choices and the ability to be vaccinated. But when we look at statewide ICU, that's a statewide metric. But locally, our 14-day case rate per 100,000 is at 374 per 100,000, which that metric is at 325 per 100,000 is the high level of transmission. And if there were some good news or some good takeaways from this, we find ourselves at 7.69% positivity over a 7-day average, which leaves us in the moderate category. So really, before the ICU utilization began to creep up, we were in moderate. But as that has gone up across the state, it bumped a lot of counties, mainly those that are have a higher population, into that high transmission index.
So it's the state that determines that transmission level?
It is.
And at what point are we going to get on a metric that every county and state are using across the country? Because it just seems so confusing that we've got something, you know, that the CDC uses, and then Summit County uses this, and then the state uses that. I mean, can't we just figure that out?
I'd love to figure that out. You know, ultimately, there's a lot of things that we can't agree on from state to state, including what we're allowed to do in our schools in terms of mask mandates and what we're allowed to do in terms of COVID response. And so you begin to see a little bit of that political divide in the response on this. So I think that this transmission index is adopted by all 13 health departments across the state and used that way. The state health department supports this and keeps track of this. And really, that's the reason that we've stuck with this one and not gone with the CDC recommendations, because this is something that's been consistent for us throughout the entire COVID response. And we wanted to make sure that people understood that our values and the data that we're using to determine our actions has not changed. And this is one of those things, this transmission index.
When was the last time that Summit County was at that high transmission level? Do you recall?
It was back in the late winter, early spring, when we were kind of coming down off of that last surge that we had.
Yeah. And are all of these new cases, I mean, are they due to the Delta variant, or do we just assume that they are?
You know, a lot of the cases we've been told it's as high as 85% of the new cases that have been evaluated and tracked are the Delta variant. So it's safe to say that that's the predominant strain throughout the U.S. and including Utah.
Yeah. And in terms of the number of cases that we're seeing here in Summit County, do we know how many of those can be blamed on unvaccinated?
Yeah, generally right now, the last metric that I saw, or the last measurement, was that 95% of cases are unvaccinated individuals. The 5% that tend to, be a breakthrough case is the term that's being used. Their symptoms are extremely mild. There have been a few hospitalizations across the state in breakthrough cases, but generally speaking, those are older adults or immunocompromised adults anyways. And so when we think about the outcomes for immunocompromised and older adults without vaccines, it was the worst outcome you can imagine. But now we're talking about these individuals unfortunately contracting COVID but still having positive outcomes, and the fact that they're able to leave the hospital and resume life. So really good news that the vaccines are performing as we would have expected. They're still performing at the numbers that were originally reported through the studies. And even though the Delta variant seems to have a higher rate of breakthrough with the vaccines, it's still proving effective and doing what it's supposed to do.
And we heard last week about the young girl who has had COVID not once, not twice, but three times. How is that possible?
You know, I don't know the details of that. It's unfortunate that any child would have COVID once, but twice or a third time it's not unheard of. There are cases of the CDC has reported in their weekly reports of multiple reinfections for individuals, but I don't know the details behind that case.
Hmm. So in terms of now being in the high transmission level, what does that mean in terms of what happens? I mean, does the county need to enforce gatherings? Does it, do we start looking at masks, indoors? I mean, what does it mean that that we're in that high level?
Yeah, it's the way the legislation is written is, when we hit the previous three metrics identified in one of the recent legislative bills, it removed the requirement for masks. It also did away with the guidelines and a number of other things that we had become accustomed to as a layered mitigation strategy for events. As we move into the fall and as we've explored these opportunities, it appears as though the recent legislation does allow local health authorities and local governments to act in behalf of large gatherings of over 50 where social distancing is impossible. We don't know what that looks like yet, but the timing of that understanding is impeccable because we're moving into that time of year for our events. And so that's something that we've tasked a couple of staff at the health department to begin looking into. I'm not sure what that looks like right now, but it's definitely something that needs to be considered. And as Tom just mentioned in the previous interview, begin working with our businesses, with our large gatherings, with our event promoters and those types of events to understand what this is going to look like moving into the fall and then into the winter.
Yeah, how worried are you about this fall and winter?
Obviously, there are things that keep me up at night. Mainly, my focus is understanding what's going to happen in the schools. I have children that are school age as well, so that the concerns that parents share, I share as well. But I'm really interested to see what's going to happen with our state elected officials, not our local elected officials. Our county council, Park City Council, Tom Fisher, Jana have been tremendous in support. They've continued to support us from day one, and we're lucky to have them. But at the state level, I have to wonder at what point action is taken there. We have data to show what's occurred, and it's anecdotal and sometimes it's qualitative, but we have data of what's occurred back east with some of our larger school districts back there and the number of cases. And I have to think, and maybe it's the Pollyanna in me, but I have to think that at some point we're going to have a conversation about what this looks like moving into the fall at a statewide level. For us locally, we'll continue to make decisions based on information that we have, based on what we hear from our stakeholders, and of course what the science is telling us. And we'll continue to make those decisions. We'll continue to drive good policy with the support of our elected officials, and hopefully, fingers crossed, get through what we hope is our last winter of COVID.
Yeah. So is Summit County looking at a K through 12 mask mandate?
We're always evaluating. We're always assessing, looking at what we have available. Right now, I looked at the cases this morning in our school-aged children. It's still low. You know, we look at what's occurring elsewhere around the state, and they're starting to see cases pop up. Our superintendents have been phenomenal. They're in as tough a position, if not tougher, than anybody else, trying to navigate both health and education. And they have been real true champions of this effort. And so continued conversations with them. We'll look at what the data shows us, work with the state, work with our elected officials, and continue to assess. As Tom said, we have September 22nd. It's quickly approaching. That's the date of we have to reevaluate the 30-day emergency order, at which time we'll have some data under our belt that we can look at, see what's occurring in the schools, and make the best choice for Summit County at that point.
Yeah. You know, we've heard a couple of disturbing reports from Wasatch County school districts, one from a teacher, one from a grandparent, about kids mocking kids showing up in masks. Are we hearing about similar reports here in Summit County schools?
I haven't heard of anything directly, but as we know, kids can be very difficult. They can be challenging to one another, and it's unfortunate that the idea that we need to be kind to each other hasn't carried over at least this far into the pandemic. So I would encourage anybody that sees somebody wearing a mask, understand we don't know what their situation is. We don't know what their situation at home is. We don't know the health of their parents or the health of their children. It's just be kind. We're still all in this together. We still have to push through this together. And let's do what we can to make sure that as a community, we stick together and get through COVID.
Yeah, and I guess I'm still confused, and I think probably others are as well. I mean, it just seems like we've got different standards for every county and every school district. So, I mean, if somebody here in Summit County is exposed to another person who tests positive for COVID, what needs to happen? I mean, state guidelines say that you have to wait 7 days to be tested after that exposure. Had a friend say that he could be tested 5 days after being exposed and receiving a negative rapid test. So who's right? Who do you listen to?
All of the above. and that's the complexity of this situation is when you look at the different influences that are directing this response, our first and foremost goal is to keep kids in school. And so when we look at what the Utah Department of Health has come up with in conjunction with the 13 local health officers, the idea is finding that middle ground between keeping kids in school and keeping kids safe. And so there are some school districts that are a lot more proactive and more progressive, and then there are others that are handling it a different way or that have additional mitigation strategies. And so the great thing about this is we've been able to help the school districts with some of their staffing through a grant that we received from Utah Department of Health to hire additional staff and determine, based on the guidelines put out by the Department of Health, what is best for each individual situation. You know, if you're vaccinated and exposed, that's different than if you're exposed next and both people have masks on versus if you're exposed to somebody and you had a mask on. So, you know, the one thing we have to keep in mind, and I know it's a frustration for many people, but this is science at work. It's science in real time, and we're learning as we go. New information becomes available every day. We keep our thumbs on the pulse as best we can, but things are going to change throughout this response because we learn from mistakes that have been made in the past, and we get better moving forward. So not to say it's perfect and not to say it's error-free, but it is a best-case approach to keep kids in school and to keep them healthy.
Now, are the symptoms of this Delta variant different than what we've seen?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I was just reading an article recently that said that some of the symptoms, it's a wider variety of symptoms, from GI, clear through headaches, And then the traditional respiratory stuff. So I think it's really how our body responds to it, the different environmental exposures we've had. But traditionally speaking, it's the same symptoms that we've heard about. You know, if you're just not feeling right, if something doesn't feel good, stay home. I know there's a nasty head cold going around right now that people have. So with that being said, if there's any question, get tested. We've opened up additional testing sites or hours in the county here over at the Park City High School, and thanks to the Park City School District for that. But yeah, the symptoms, generally speaking, are as they've been from day one with the native strain, and that's the chest congestion, fever, cough, runny nose, sore throat, those type of symptoms.
Yeah. Now, the mask order that is in effect for elementary grade students, I mean, it's based on a 2%, I think, of cases. Is this really any more restrictive than what we had in place? That seems to be a little bit more lax.
Lax probably is not the appropriate word, but it's definitely less restrictive in the terms that, you know, with some of the confusion around authority and where that authority lies in terms of mask mandates in schools and that type of thing, we had to be very careful in the order that was put together. And as we look at what's occurring now around around the state, I'm proud of what the county was able to accomplish with this order. We haven't seen it go into effect, which means that we have low case counts. But again, this is science in real time, and we're learning as we go. And there's a reason that you don't see 13 mask orders around the state, and that's because there's not one right way of doing it. And so as we mentioned earlier, we'll continue to evaluate, continue to assess, and determine what's best for Summit County here mid-September when this we're due to extend or at least propose an extension if necessary to our county council.
Okay. And then this just coming in, that Park City Song Summit is announcing that it is canceling the event for this year in the interest of public and artist safety. They are targeting next September 8th through the 11th, 2022 for those rescheduled dates. They will be issuing refunds within the next 14 business days. Were you part of their decision in all of this?
Absolutely. Ben Anderson has been an absolute champion in this community. He made a very tough decision yesterday in consultation with the health department, in consultation with Park City Municipal, and then some other disease experts that he's been working with. And that was a tough decision. And while we didn't direct Ben in any one direction, based on the information that he received from those different constituents and stakeholders, he made the decision, or him and his group made the decision, to postpone. And I think that's a pat on the back to Ben. It's a heroic effort. I know he struggled with the decision, obviously not because of COVID, but because of the different commitments that were made. But ultimately, he made the decision to err on the side of health of this community, and he deserves to be commended for that.
Okay. Finally, wanted to ask you about boosters. Is the county health department going to gear up a kind of a booster vaccine clinic like we saw with the original vaccinations?
Yeah, more likely on a very small scale, possibly some satellite locations, but it won't be like what we saw at the Utah Film Studio. We still haven't received final approval from the federal government to issue booster doses for the general population at that 8-month time frame. Right now it is being offered to immunocompromised individuals that fit a very small list of health conditions, and we have been issuing those at the health department. But I really think that this booster effort will be driven by the local pharmacies, primary care physicians. Obviously we'll have appointments at the health department, and I think when you look at that statewide, there's enough capacity there to deal with it. I think that you will see the health department ramp up in some capacity when the vaccines become available for 6 to 11-year-olds. I have a vested interest not only in managing COVID, but getting kids that want to be vaccinated, and their parents want them vaccinated as soon as possible. And so speaking with our nursing director and individuals in the county, we are committed to getting shots in the arms of kids as soon as possible once that becomes available. So we are in talks about what that will look like. Come hopefully Thanksgiving time is what we're hearing, but we've been told by the state to plan for January. So almost a year out from when we issued it for adults. But nonetheless, we will be ready when that time comes to issue a lot of shots over a short amount of time.
So would that then maybe return to the film studio, or could you do that at the hospital and health department? Or
I think it's probably the latter. I don't think the film studio will be the primary choice, but when we look at possible events during the school day, working with superintendents, school nurses, our nursing staff, there's a lot of options that we have in place, and we're still vetting out what the best one might be. But it will be, in typical Summit County fashion, it will be efficient, it will be fast, and it will be quite an event.
Yeah, and are there any word on those that a number of people I know here in town receiving the Johnson & Johnson, just a single dose? Any mm-hmm. updates with where they might get, when they might get a booster?
Yeah, that's one of the things that has remained a mystery with the state health department, is that we were told that because of some of the difficulties with the Johnson & Johnson manufacturing process and one of their plants going down back east, that we won't have any Johnson & Johnson in the county or in the state until late fall. And so we don't have any of the one dose opportunities for individuals right now. And I'm not up to speed at this point on what the booster doses look like for the Johnson & Johnson. I know that most of the focus has been on the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines.
Yeah. Okay. Phil, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think we're good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your time. That's Summit County Health Director, Dr. Phil Bondurant. Well, the Friends of the Park City Library used book sale will be held this Labor Day weekend. And in the studio with details, I've got Jean Daly and Erby Leary with Friends of the Park City Library Board. Good morning, ladies. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Hi, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
Okay. One at a time here. So the sale, 3 days only. Members are getting an early bird preview. Do you want to start, Erby? I mean, what are the hours this year?
Yes. The hours are Saturday 9 to 10:30. The members only can have first dibs on our thousands of books, and you can become a member at 9:30 and 9 o'clock as well if you want to get that early bird special. Then open to the public 10:30 to 2, and Sundays 9 to 2, Mondays 9 to 2, but that's the special Fill Your Bag for $10 day.
So okay, is it Fill Your Bag, the Friends of the Library
fill
bag?
Fill the Friends of the Library bag.
Okay, so that's right. Basically you pay $10 a bag and you can fill it
with as many books as you can put in there.
Yeah, how strong are they?
Very strong.
They're bigger and better this year, and this year we went with yellow. So, I mean, yellow and bigger and better, so you'll get a lot of books in there.
Okay, what's the cost of a membership then to be, if you purchase it at the door?
As low as $25.
Okay, all right. And then in terms of just the layout this year, are we going to put everything onto the third floor, or are you spreading it out through the building?
We're going to have everything on the third floor. So we have one room that's dedicated to children's books, and then we use the community room, and those are all the nonfiction. And then we go down to the stage and the auditorium, and that's all fiction.
Okay, so third floor, we're going to limit
it to. Third floor, everything, yeah. And we've got, Leslie, we have millions of books.
Well, because we didn't have a sale last year.
We didn't have a sale last year. We had, in February of last year, a man say he had books to donate. He donated 56 boxes of fiction books. So we have books.
Okay. You had a little pop-up sale over the 4th of July.
It was very successful, too. We were so surprised. We had almost 50% more purchases in July than we had the year before. So there's pent-up demand.
Right. And of course, all of this depends on the generosity of our community. You know, people were cleaning out during the pandemic, mm-hmm. so we got that. And then, you know, with this setup, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes that go in. So, you know, all the city workers come in at 7 o'clock Thursday morning, and they work and run up and down those stairs and in the elevator, and they bring all of our boxes up and set them on the tables that we've already set up. The biggest thing we need now is we need volunteers for Friday. Friday is the day they take all of the books out of the boxes and set them up. We have everything arranged for them alphabetically, but we need volunteers. So the community, of course, you know, that's what makes our sale work, and the volunteers are the backbone.
Yeah, so what are those hours then on Friday?
With 9 until 2, and so we have it on Sign Up Genius. So all they have to do is go on the library website, and there's a I Want to Volunteer section after they see under events, and they just go on and sign up.
All right.
At this point, they could show up, Leslie. We'd be fine.
Okay. Have you filled the other shifts, though, that you needed to? So you're looking throughout the week?
We're looking throughout the week.
Right. And especially on Monday, we close at 2 o'clock, but there are volunteer opportunities. And if you volunteer after 2 o'clock, you can take home all the books that you see for free.
Okay. Can't beat that. Otherwise, books are pretty darn cheap. Right.
They certainly are. $2 for hardbacks, $1 for paperback, and $1 for children's.
Okay. And you've kind of limited what you accept anymore. You used to take videos, no more. Do you still have some DVDs and books on
We'd
tape?
We'd like to limit, but, you know, we take whatever comes in the door. Mm-hmm. So in the front of the library right now, there's a cart that has free books on it, and it's full of movies.
Yeah. Okay. And then you always do have books left over. What happens to them? You don't haul them back upstairs, do you?
We do not haul them back upstairs. They go to an organization that distributes them and takes care of them.
Okay. Araby, tell us about some of the things that Friends Donations and the book sale has paid for over the last couple of years.
Of course. And we do all the things that most of the things that the library asks us for. And my favorite is the guinea pigs, but that's just a minor thing because that's always a crowd pleaser. We support Tutor.com, which some people don't know about. Now we've spread that information to schools in Park City, and you can go online and get tutoring. Of course, the planter boxes and the summer flowers on the patio. But books, rapid readers, the ones that are most popular, lease program through Baker & Taylor, and also help for the librarians with a scanner to help them bring the books in quicker so that they can be more available to the community when people come in and ask questions.
And we do all of their receptions. We support the art and author sessions that they have. We buy all the toys for the dog park and the and then in the winter coasters and snow coasters and all of those things. We also partnered with Martintown Music and are doing music on the patio. I think we've done that 3 years. The last 3 years we've done that. And, of course, then books. Books, books, books.
And for those who may not be around this weekend, you do have year-round your kind of book wall as mm-hmm. you walk into the library, just that right-hand
We do, turn. And we're really, really stocking it. And we started heavy stocking it about February or March when things started to calm down a little bit because that was going to be one of our fundraisers, you know, because this is our largest fundraiser. Mm-hmm. The next thing we have is Live PC, Give PC, which, of course, we are supported. But this is the major thing that raises money so that we can support all of these other things.
Okay. You have also, in years past, held the annual Friends Author Luncheon. What's the word on that?
We are not having it this year. Instead, we're supporting all of the author programs that the library is doing. So they partner with the Utah Humanities Association, and so they're having, I don't know, 3 or 4 authors coming, I think, mm-hmm. between September and October. And we just had an author on the patio. 5 authors were there. So we've just decided to err on the side of caution. We aren't having it this year.
Okay, and just reevaluate. It's not that the program's ended.
It's the wrong time.
Yeah. So you'll reevaluate.
Which we're sorry not to have it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Again, Friends of the Library are looking for volunteers this Friday to help out moving books 9 to 2, and again throughout the weekend. I guess the big need is really that setup and cleanup, huh? Mm-hmm.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And people to come.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, my cheap addiction. I have to be there. Okay.
Excellent.
Anything else?
No, I don't think so. You know, Leslie, we've had people that have come for the last 10 years. I mean, I recognize people that brought their babies in, you know, and now the baby's 7 years old. So it's a wonderfully, wonderfully supported event. We hope that it's robust this year.
Okay. Again, the used book sale happening by the Park City Friends of the Library this weekend. So I'm volunteering Sunday morning, 9 to 2, and they were just telling me I'm by myself. So go to parkcitylibrary.org and sign up to be a volunteer. It's so much fun walking around those books. Just, I can't stand it. It's my favorite weekend of the year. Okay, what else have we got going on here? The Park City School District has a zero tolerance policy for bullying, discrimination, hate, bias, and retaliation. That's the Park City Board of Education's message after a viral video of an assault took place last week at Treasure Mountain Junior High School. KPCW's Carolyn Murray reports on the rumor mill now circulating in the aftermath.
Park City Board of Education President Aaron Grady said the ongoing investigation makes it impossible to discuss specific details of the assault captured on video last Thursday. She said the Safe Schools policy outlines consequences, which she cannot discuss until the investigation finishes. Asked about rumors that the altercation resulted from a racial ethnic slur involving an Asian teacher, Grady said she had not received specific information about that. She commented to KPCW on behalf of the Board of Education.
No matter what, stands against discrimination and hate against people in all realms. And we 100% stand with our Asian American community. Moving forward, if people have incidents of bias against anyone within the district, it does have a zero tolerance. So if you are a victim or a witness to a bias or incident, we encourage you and want you to report the incident, whether online or coming to the district or someone in administration immediately. And, you know, this is not just a school issue. This is a community issue. So we have to work together with this one as a community and make sure that we have an inclusive learning and working environment in our district and our community.
Grady said she does not know if other students had witnessed bullying or heard ethnic slurs or whether the administration received complaints before the incident. The video, shot by students and shared on Snapchat, shows other students present.
I cannot talk about the video at all. It is part of the investigation, the ongoing investigation, so I cannot.
Grady said the school district's zero tolerance policy addresses gang activity and weapons in school. When asked if the incident was gang related, she replied,
I can say that there is no evidence or any reason for us as a district to believe that that is the manner. And again, that there has been no evidence of any weapons, which again falls under the safe schools and is again a zero tolerance.
On Friday, Treasure Mountain Junior High School Principal Caleb Fine sent a video statement to the school community.
Swift action was taken to address the situation. I am happy to report that there was a teacher and a staff member working with the student within 1 minute, and all students involved were in the office within 90 seconds of the incident taking place. Fortunately, no staff members or students were injured during the incident.
Grady said seeing the assault on the video was disturbing.
So I can't speak on behalf of the parents. I can tell you that there was no medical attention needed from what I understand that happened from the incident, but I would say I think, of course, I'm a parent and I can't imagine the emotional impact that this has on a child or other children as well.
The school district is providing additional counseling as a follow-up. Grady said students, faculty, and parents can contact the counseling office, a trusted teacher, or anyone at the district for support. She said those involved in circulating the video are also under investigation because the act of furthering disruption using social media is a violation of the Safe Schools policy.
That is a part of the investigation, so I can't comment a whole lot on it. But again, it goes, we have policies for our social media, and it also goes back to our policies for safe schools and for anti-bullying. So we fall back in all of that. But yes, there are consequences, and those are under investigation as well.
As KPCW reported earlier, the school board sent a letter to the community on Sunday night. You can find the letter on kpcw.org. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Michael Fisher here with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, longtime supporter of KPCW. I love supporting this station and have grown up in this great community and appreciate all it has to offer to locals and visitors alike. I offer real estate services for all of the Wasatch back and can be reached at 435-659-7973 or Michael Fisher at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, this is Aldi Milliken, Executive Director of the Kimball Art Center, a nonprofit organization supporting KPCW. We provide our local community access to international quality art exhibitions and dynamic educational opportunities. Art is a catalyst providing you an outlet for reflection, creativity, and new ways of thinking, encouraging compassion and connection. Join us at our new location at 1251 Kearns, Tuesday through Sunday. Learn more about the current exhibition, hours, and upcoming classes at KimballArtCenter.org.
And once again, just this coming out just this hour, Park City Song Summit says it will be postponing its event this year in the interest of public and artist safety. It's basically been canceled for the year. They are targeting next September 8th through the 11th, 2022, to reschedule the event. The statement that they have made is that with the ICUs at 100% capacity and county going from moderate to high level of transmission late last week, with school-aged children being admitted to increasing numbers in local hospitals and matching our single-day high for new positive cases. The founder of the Park City Song Summit, Ben Anderson, said that they have just decided that this is what the current COVID climate is requiring them to do. After countless conversations with top health officials, infectious disease experts, and local government, he said, we cannot hold this event safely at this time, and then we'll need to postpone the Song Summit until 2022. Anderson said that organizers have tried their absolute hardest to make the event work in the current mid-pandemic environment. He says they've tried valiantly to adapt the rising dangers by moving all of their long-scheduled indoor events outside, reducing the capacity significantly, implementing various COVID protocols, but even with such extreme moves, he said, they still didn't feel like it was enough to overcome the risk of a dangerous COVID-19 spread. Again, refunds will be issued within the next 14 business days. You can follow Park City Song Summit on social media for the latest updates. The team behind the Song Summit, he says, has been so moved and inspired by the support of artists and fans, and want to express their gratitude in advance for your understanding and patience as they build toward next year.